Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter and producer at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a weekly series of coronavirus conversations presented jointly with The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, taking your questions to the experts. This discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you here in The World's podcast feed. This week, we spoke with Dr. Michael Minna, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, about advances in coronavirus testing and fighting the surge. So, Michael, for as long as we've been talking about COVID-19, we, and I guess more specifically you, have been talking a lot about testing. It seems like we're always a step behind. When we spoke in February and in March, federal test kits weren't working, and that prompted a critical delay in testing, one that you called out quite a bit back then. And so now we're more than 6 months into this thing, after the virus was first identified. Some U.S. cities are still running out of working test kits. So I wonder if, to start, we could ask and talk to you about where are we now on testing, and where do you see us needing to be to prevent future surges?
Yeah, well, it's unfortunately feeling a little bit like deja vu at the moment. As you mentioned, back in February and March, you and I were sitting physically in the School of Public Health at Harvard talking about this same issue. And at that point, there was just no testing in the US. Now, of course, we've come a long way in terms of the numbers of tests, but unfortunately, the virus pretty much always moves faster than we're able to scale up testing. And so what we're seeing now, especially as cases have really grown in the southeast and west of the country, the major laboratories that normally perform the tests have become once again backlogged, and we're seeing delays, 5, 6, 7, 8 day delays, which makes testing itself a very, you know, difficult to interpret and sort of difficult to use that information once it's that long of a delay. But I think although we are seeing sort of a deja vu of testing delays, we're also seeing progress. There are a number of manufacturers and companies that are getting closer and closer every day to getting point of care and rapid tests out. And we're also just seeing the access to tests increase. Of course, it's lagging behind the cases, but in much of the country where cases are not burgeoning at the moment, testing is actually available. In Massachusetts, we actually have, we're not using all of the capacity for tests that we have. There are some laboratories that have tens of thousands of additional tests that they could be performing daily, but just aren't because there's not necessarily the demand at the moment. So unfortunately, this is continuing to expose sort of the problem of being such a large, geographically large country, but also such a heterogeneous country and a country that's divided into states. We are not able to really easily load balance the testing that is available to provide enough testing for Florida and Texas at the moment, using the tests that are available in Massachusetts, for example. So I think we have a lot of work to go, a lot of work to do to sort of get to where we really need to be, I think.
So how do you envision testing being used effectively to slow the spread of COVID-19? Do you think about like everyone in Massachusetts being tested or everyone in Florida being tested or requiring a test before you go to a movie theater or the office, or let's say you're an essential worker, or let's say you're in prison? Like, how do you see this being used, the testing now, effectively?
Yeah, I think that we can certainly divide up the tests. I think that what we should really be focusing on is, in order to load balance a little bit better anyway and get testing where they need to go and get the results back in a timely manner, which I would suggest really should be within a day, if not shorter, would be to have a dynamic situation where we can say, okay, right now we have X number of tests and they are absolutely more crucial at the moment in Florida and Texas than they are in Massachusetts. So maybe we can start somehow deploying our tests there and getting people results back. I mean, getting results back to people quicker. Unfortunately, the samples, these are still centralized tests. So they still need to, the sample needs to come from a swab or from saliva from somebody and be shipped up to the lab, wherever that lab might be. So that does pose serious problems with getting fast turnaround times. Just the shipping alone ends up being almost a day. So where I think that we can really excel is to create more point of care tests. These would be tests that somebody could use daily. So a test that somebody could actually use sort of right before they walk into the nursing home to go visit their parents or grandparents. That in a setting like a prison where transmission can, where once an outbreak starts, it's extremely difficult to stop in a setting like that. Maybe you actually use tests every day. Hmm. And if we can devise tests that are cheap enough to do that, I think that that's where we should really be, where we should be aiming anyway. And unfortunately, the centralized laboratory tests are probably not going to provide that type of rapid feedback. You want to know, in reality, as we're walking around, we want to know now, am I transmitting this virus? And if I have that information, then I can make important decisions that will stop me from going and transmitting the virus further. And we've seen this work before with HIV. It was all about letting people know their status, and then they decide to not have risky behavior if they find out that they're positive. The same thing here. If somebody finds out that they're positive, then they go and they self-quarantine and they continue using these sort of at-home tests, for example, until they become negative. So that's the kind of rapid feedback I think we really need. We're not there yet, unfortunately, but I do envision that that's the way to, if we're going to look to testing as a way to stop this virus versus just sort of brute force close everything down again, I think that we need to absolutely focus on getting turnaround times quicker, within minutes, not days, and definitely not weeks, and getting access to the tests where they most are needed. So we don't have to, if we want to roll out new types of tests that are faster, and give them to everyone to use every day or every 3 days or the like. We don't have to do that for 325 million people tomorrow. We need to do it for the millions of people that are in the hardest hit areas right now, and then slowly continue expanding the manufacturing and production of these tests.
What does the difference mean between knowing your results in 5 minutes and a day even? Why is that important?
So the virus transmits once the virus grows inside of people, it grows rapidly. It grows exponentially. And so that means you can go from having a few virus particles in your nose today to having a billion in your nose tomorrow or the day after. And so it's when people have very high virus titers that they are most likely to transmit. But people aren't actually staying at those very high titers for all that long. Usually the virus will grow very high in somebody's respiratory tract. And then it will, over a pretty short period of time, the immune system will start beating it down and the virus will start to, the virus growth inside the body will start to become limited again. And at that point, people become increasingly less transmissible. So the reason I bring that sort of those dynamics up, where people kind of go really high in virus titers and then pretty low after just a few days, maybe 4 or 5 days, it just goes to show how important it is to get results back. If you're going to test somebody on the third day that they are infected, if it takes 3 days to get the results back, then their most transmissible period would have already happened by the time they find out they're positive. At that point, they've just spent the last 3 days walking around and potentially infecting others. So I think that it's extremely important to get results. If you could have them immediately, then all of a sudden we can start doing things that we can't currently feel comfortable doing. And that would be if one of us want to walk into a nursing home, unless we have been extraordinarily careful and not seen anyone in the last, you know, few weeks, we really don't know our status of positivity. And certainly, at least in the last week, if we haven't kept track of that well, then we don't know our status of transmissibility. So even if I get a test yesterday to go in to a nursing home today, I don't really know if I was just negative yesterday because the virus hadn't had a chance to grow enough. And actually today I'm teeming with virus and could walk in and spread it despite having a negative result yesterday. So it's really about understanding what is your status now at the time that you actually want to do something where transmission might occur if you are infected. And that's why it's just so incredibly important to at least start thinking about ways to get test results very quick. There are a few manufacturers that make them, and I advocate for companies like Abbott and Quidel. They have 10-minute turnaround time tests. It's hard to really scale those to huge numbers, but I can envision, for example, those instruments being sitting at the front of a nursing home. And if you want to go in and see your family member, you actually have to get tested and you get a result back in 10 or 15 minutes. We're starting to see some of those actually at Walgreens and CVS kind of places as well.
When I think about the HIV tests, the take-home ones are not cheap. And so how do you envision this being played out differently? And we are there's lots of questions here, but I wanted to kind of have us first talk about kind of also setting just sort of the foundation. And after that, I hope we can get to just kind of a breakdown of the different types of testing, the accuracy, how they work as well.
Yeah, so I think that they can be made very cheaply. So there are certain ones, the ones that exist now, the Abbott instrument, for example, it's a very good instrument, but it's actually expensive to use. And that's because it has a lot of reagents, meaning a lot of sort of parts to it, and it gives a very, very accurate answer. There's a whole different class of tests that are kind of about to become available, or they're in sort of late stages of development. And these are tests that are really, like they're paper strips, essentially, much like a pregnancy test. I wrote an op-ed about it in the New York Times recently with Larry Kotlikoff. We kind of were calling for these types of paper strip tests to be used daily. And what these are essentially just, if you think of a pregnancy test, but you take away all the plastic that's around it, it's really just a little piece of paper with some proteins embedded on the paper. And you could make these very cheaply. They can be printed in big sheets and then sliced into hundreds or thousands of little tests. And everyone, I envision a day when everyone has like a little packet of 50 tests that they can go and buy for $50. And maybe that can get them through 3 months of testing, for example. And versus right now, the average PCR test, the laboratory-based test is $50 for one test. Mm-hmm. So if we can get the cost down to $1 or so, and then we can actually have the US government be the ones funding the availability of these tests and hopefully the manufacturing of these tests, then I think we actually can get to a point where with subsidized sort of costs, we can get everyone tested, including the people who are most vulnerable, which tend to be lower socioeconomic status.
So it sounds like the technology is actually there, and what you're saying is there is feasibility for this. It's just not quite happening yet.
Yeah, the reason that it's not happening yet, in my opinion, is that these tests take a hit in terms of their sensitivity. And this makes everyone squeamish at the FDA, at the CDC. But I think that if we can change our view of how we evaluate tests, we don't need to evaluate tests on a per test basis. We don't have to know, is it going to detect if somebody has just two viral copies in their nose? If somebody has the opportunity to take it multiple times a week or multiple times a day even, then you don't have to have such a good analytical sensitivity to detect small numbers of molecules. Because again, people will transmit this virus when they have billions of molecules in their nose, not thousands. So as long as these little cheap paper strip tests can detect billions or millions of molecules in the nose at any given time, if they exist, then they become very powerful tools. But we have to change our view, because that's not how we normally think of diagnostic tests. We think of a clinical diagnostic test, we usually want it to be very, very sensitive, because you're usually thinking you have kind of one shot at goal. Somebody comes into the doctor's office, they want to know if they're sick. This is just a different way to look at it, where we have to look at sort of the accumulated sensitivity of the test. If you take 10 tests over 2 weeks and you get exposed during that period of time, then they're very likely to turn positive, even if they're not individually all that sensitive.
I do want to get to questions, but just to clarify what we're talking about testing when somebody has an active infection. And so how does that differentiate from like an antibody test, and is there a use for that? And then we're gonna dig into a lot of the questions that have been coming in.
Yeah, so the antibody testing, and just to clarify further, what I've been referring to as the use of these would be really used for surveillance testing, how to kind of control the outbreaks that are happening. If somebody's really sick and goes into their doctor's office because they feel very sick, give them the more expensive test. But if they're feeling fine and they're just part of a surveillance program, then give them the more frequent, cheaper test. The antibody testing is a whole different approach. And that is more on in line with there's a couple things that antibody testing can answer now, and then a couple things that they will be able to answer later. Later, they'll be able to tell us more information about how protected is somebody individually. If they have very high antibody titers, meaning levels, can we find sort of correlates of protection where if you have above a certain level of antibody, you're protected from infection? Or reinfection, for example. So that detail, that level of detail is something we're still exploring. But how these could be used today is we could actually use them as pretty good outbreak detection systems. It's cheaper and easier to run an antibody test than a PCR test. And so if we could, for example, be monitoring, give, and you could do it just from a prick of a finger prick of blood, just like a diabetic type of finger prick. And so what you could do is you could give everyone filter paper, these little cards that you put a drop of blood on. Everyone in a state, for example, could test themselves on a regular basis, maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks. And that means on any given day, you're maybe testing 1/15th of the population or 1/14th of the population if it's every 2 weeks. And that becomes a very powerful tool to know if an outbreak is starting to emerge. And so we can really use antibody testing for public health uses right now, in a way that would be very profound and would go a long way to help us both monitor, control, and contain outbreaks. And then the idea would be if you start to find an outbreak, then you start to really deploy PCR and virus testing there. So the antibody testing is sort of your upfront screen to know if an outbreak is emerging. And then the virus testing is when you know that an outbreak is happening, start to deploy the resources there to really bring it back under control.
This question's from Lisa, from the World's Facebook page. So then, what are the barriers to getting more tests? Do other countries have tests we could buy to increase our testing? Can you lay this out?
The barriers are really come down to it's this has been the it really is deja vu. Early on, it was we didn't have enough tests, and then for a while we had enough tests and we didn't have enough swabs, and now we have enough swabs but not enough tests again because cases are so high. So the barrier to testing today is truly the physical layout of the laboratories performing the tests. There are not enough robots to perform the tests that we need. Now there are amazing innovations happening right now, ways to take a single robot and be able to do tens of thousands of tests at a given time. So we're going to see some of those centralized laboratories be able to really scale up. But there's still a piece that's always going to become the limiting factor here. And that's the ability to just literally get the tests, the swabs into a laboratory. And if you're getting, you might have robots that can potentially test a million tests a day, but it's organizing those and making sure that you're reading the barcode on every single label, for example, all of what we normally call the pre-analytical step, the step of organizing, saying this test belongs to John Doe, and when I get the result back, I need to be able to give John Doe the result. That part is pretty limited right now in terms of how quickly we can do it, because it actually requires that somebody to actually be taking in the tests into a laboratory and running them through barcode readers. So if we can figure out how to accelerate that, I think we can actually start to really improve our turnaround time. And that's where we need a lot of mechanical engineering and things that have nothing to do with biomedicine to really take hold. And that's what one thing that Quest and LabCorp, these two major companies, have really been pushing more and more over the years, and now more than ever. But still, this means you have to funnel huge numbers of tests into small numbers of labs. And it's why I think the real thing that we need to do, the real barrier that can be broken down, is being able to distribute the test to individuals in their households. And if we can do that, then we can really open up testing for everyone.
This question's from online. What about the possibility of using group testing? That's been talked about, where you screen a large number of people, like college students, people working in a factory all at once. How might that process help in reopening workplaces and schools? What are the upsides, the downsides?
Yeah, so group testing can be very powerful. And but again, it's oftentimes this pre-analytical stage. So group testing, unfortunately, won't be the savior here. It sounds great because we could do, for every test, we could actually be running or processing 20 or 30 or 100 samples potentially. But we still need to do all of our due diligence to know what samples are making up that pool. And once, if prevalence increases, you usually have to then say, if you get a positive pool, you then have to identify which was the culprit in that pool that led it to be positive. So once prevalence of the virus increases just a bit in a population, and you start having every pool turn positive, for example, every 1 in 10 swabs becomes positive, which is actually about where many places are right now. 10% of swabs are positive. It actually starts to slow the process down because you have to then take a pool and you have to divide it back out and figure out which was the positive one. So it can help, but it helps the most when cases are very low.
Going back to just a lot of increase in testing, whether it's a rapid test like what you're talking about, take home or not. This question is about privacy from online. And someone writes, I see the value of fast at-home testing, but the strategy seems to challenge our current practices around medical privacy. What are the legal and ethical ramifications of requiring that people disclose medical tests before they participate in ordinary activities?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one that's fraught with some ethics, but I would say that it certainly does become difficult, but this is always the tension between public health and individual level health. I would say that this virus doesn't, it's so transmissible, it's infecting millions and millions of people. At the very beginning, there was a lot of stigma associated with getting this, but this isn't a virus to be ashamed of getting, for example. And it's something, I think if that's a real concern, then we are pretty off in terms of our, where we are with society in terms of what's important. I think that there should be no stigma attached to getting this. It's a virus that you can pick up just by taking the subway or, walking to work. And the important thing is it's not a permanent state. We're not asking people to disclose, their HIV status or anything like that. I think that it's a respiratory virus, no different than influenza. And I would say in this case, it's more important to prevent spread to others than to preserve the sort of privacy in terms of this particular result for an individual. And people can, you don't necessarily have to disclose if you're positive. If you're negative, I think that that's probably not something too difficult to disclose. And if you're positive, just stay at home. And work it out in a private setting with your employer, for example, or someone else who you report to.
In some ways, though, this leads into another question from Trish. In terms of where the cases are coming from and how we know where they're coming from. Sorry, there's a police car in the background. So, for example, California just shut down indoor eating, hair salons, gyms, but we know that 5 recent cases were at big box stores that never closed. So she's wondering, why aren't we told where cases originate, not just like the city or zip code, and can testing help confirm this?
So we try. That would be the ideal, is to know where exactly the cases originate. It's a little bit difficult. It's one thing to go into, if somebody gets infected and then 2 days later, a contact tracer gets in touch with them and says, where were you 2 days ago? They'll definitely remember going to the hair salon, for example. It's just a thing. But if somebody stopped by a grocery store for 2 minutes and kind of forgot about it, or walked into a bank. You know, it might be more difficult to remember those types of like very normal, nuanced things that people do every day. And so I think it's certainly the ideal. We want to know where people have been. And in fact, a lot of restaurants even now and other locations, when people walk in, the host is now taking sort of a name and a phone number in case they find out that somebody during that evening that they were in the store or in the restaurant was positive. They can actually call back everyone very quickly or give those phone numbers to the contact tracers. So the idea is to know the exact location where cases may be spread. In the same way, for example, we've done this in the past many times with food poisoning. We want to know, you know, was it a picnic that the E. coli came from, or, you know, was it a certain restaurant that caused a lot of people to become ill or a certain lot of food? The same thing here. We want to know, you know, was there a venue that led to spread? But it is hard. I mean, without shutting everything down, it's going to be very hard to keep track of all of these. And again, it's because it's a virus that just spreads pretty easily and could happen without, you know, much interaction between two people.
So this kind of leads into a question that comes from Lexi Cohen and also another online question. So I'm going to combine the two kind of for a more bird's eye view question. We're based in Massachusetts. So the first question, and again, talking here with Dr. Michael Mina from Harvard School of Public Health, an epidemiologist, and we're taking your questions. So what level of concern do you have that there might be new hotspots? Or that hotspots in other states might threaten, for example, the success in Massachusetts. And that kind of also I want to combine with this other question, because places like in Massachusetts or Boston, it feels like COVID's been brought under control. But when you look at these other hotspots states, is another surge here then inevitable, or what can be done to prevent it? I realize I just threw a lot of things at you, but I think it kind of all captures this question, broader question on people's minds who are posting questions.
Yeah, it's very difficult, and this is the problem with infectious diseases. Cases anywhere, you know, especially with a respiratory virus, place everyone at risk. With, you know, across countries, we can close borders, but in the U.S., we're not going to be closing borders between states. At least, I don't think we will. And this means that, as you know, Massachusetts and New York and Vermont or wherever, you know, up here in the Northeast, we have very low cases at the moment, and we can continue to do our due diligence and keep cases very low. When I walk around outside, I don't see anyone in my area in Boston that's not wearing a mask at any given time, and so we can really bring cases down. But the problem is that we are not going to stop transportation and into the state from across the country. People are still going to be flying through the airports now that flights are going again. People are still going to be driving through the state, especially in Massachusetts, for example, where we have an enormous number of colleges and universities. Students are going to be coming back in to the state, and this causes huge problems. A few months ago, we were really hoping that we knew that we were going to have a peak here in April, and we were planning to bring cases down, and they did come down as anticipated. But the burgeoning of new cases throughout the country really makes us have to reevaluate how we've been thinking about reopening strategies in states where cases have been brought under control. Because if we start to reopen with the expectation that we have very low cases here, and then we bring 30,000 or 300,000, I'm not sure the number, of college and university students back into the state from all across the world, potentially, but certainly across the United States, if they're coming from these states that have very high levels of cases, that makes it very difficult to be opening while those individuals come back in. And so right now, Massachusetts does technically, I believe, have, for example, a 14-day quarantine. Anyone coming in from out of state is supposed to stay quarantined, but it's very difficult to enforce. There's no real way to enforce it. And now we're seeing multiple states are starting to put similar processes in place. And But it does. I don't think there's a good answer at the moment. We would have liked to be in a very different position at the moment, where we could say, okay, the U.S. is more or less as a whole has very low cases, and we can all kind of take a breath and think of ourselves as in a time in peacetime. But in some ways, we're not. We have to always be ready for new cases to be coming in from, from other states at the moment. And it's going to continue requiring, therefore, that we continue monitoring huge numbers of people all the time, in order to make sure that we're detecting each of these little transmission chains as they start to emerge and before they get out of control. Unfortunately, that's kind of the state of things. And it's particularly, I get a lot of questions. You didn't ask this, but I get a lot of questions about flying right now. And people want to know, can they fly? People have been grounded, for the most part since March. And flying is actually one of the, I think of it as one of the riskier things to do at the moment. And it's because it's one of the few times when you do have just such a mixture of people from all across the United States. So I might be at Logan Airport in Massachusetts, we're in a state with very low cases, but there might be thousands of people in Logan Airport at this very moment from Texas, Florida, and Arizona, where cases are really high. So it becomes a very difficult and dangerous, or at least risky place to be at airports. And so it's causing, having cases anywhere in the country is causing travel to be, to remain restricted, or at least to remain a very risky endeavor for everyone.
Seems like when I hear about suggestions or strong recommendations on how to contain an outbreak, there's the testing, there's the tracing part of it, and the isolating. So I wonder, do you primarily, I mean, you are very much focused on testing, but I mean, do you see then testing as something like having the testing at airports or having testing at schools as people come back to school as a way to address or prevent future outbreaks? Is that kind of where you're going with it? We also have a question here. We have to wrap up soon that asks about masks and essentially how important mask policies should be from someone who's in a place that doesn't have a lot of masks being worn. So.
Yeah, so I do think, I think of, I my focus has been sort of both the mechanics of testing and the molecular biology of testing, but also the epidemiology of this virus and how testing and things like mask wearing can actually benefit. And so I do think that, if we can distribute tests and get them out to everyone so that they could have rapid results quickly, whether that's in schools or other facilities, I do believe that that is a strategy to reduce cases. The other strategy is, of course, what we've already seen, which is closing things down and stopping human to human transmission that way. Masks are one of the most essential tools. And I remember when we spoke back in February, I believe, it might have been March at that point, the CDC was recommending no masks. And I remember us talking about that. And I distinctly remember saying, of course, masks might not be perfect, but of course they're going to block transmission. And that's still the case today. Masks work. Even a crappy mask will work. And the poorest of masks are probably like loose fabric, things like bandanas. I don't recommend them, but if you have nothing else, then double it up, triple it up, and use that. If you can get surgical masks and some of these more medical grade masks, great, they can be ordered online. But if everyone would wear a mask, then I think that we would really cut down. We would probably bring the effective R, this rate, this number that some people may have heard of. It's the reproductive number of the virus. How many people does one individual infect? It would probably bring it down below one very quickly, meaning it would stop outbreaks from growing and probably cause them to become depleted. So masks can be, they're one of the safest things to do. There's very little risk in wearing a mask. I know people have asked me about CO carbon dioxide poisoning and things, but there's no risk. You should be wearing a a mask that can breathe well. And they're simple to do. They shouldn't be a big burden on people. If you're sitting at work and you're in your office and there's nobody else around, then you can probably take it off. But when other people are around, just put it on. And that one act alone could probably serve to really stop this outbreak, I think, or at least very much diminish the cases. And so that's why I think, there was a lot of confusion around masks because early on they were said that they weren't needed. The president has definitely not advocated for masks, which has been unfortunate. And but now I think people are probably starting to get the message. I think we need just more media attention around just the, or more sort of advertising to make masks cool, that so people it becomes socialized and normal, and people feel uncomfortable, not wearing a mask in public, I think is where we need to be.
We are, thank you for that. We are about out of time, but I just wanted to give you one kind of final kind of concluding remarks or reflections, given that, it's summer, there's questions about schools and how to reopen schools. There are massive surges, records, numbers of cases in the United States right now. And as you think of this moment compared to when we first spoke, back in February. What is your biggest kind of message right now as you look ahead?
I think the message is, I would say we're in a worse position now than we were back in April and March. Unfortunately, I'd never wanted to be saying that today. And that's because we've let cases grow so much out of control that they're going to be very hard to reel in. But we do know a lot more about how to stop them. We know that masks work. We know that social distancing works to bring cases back under control. It wasn't magic that we got these cases under control in the Northeast. It was social distancing and mask wearing. So I think that I do think that it's going to be ex that there are going to be extremely tough decisions in the very near future about keeping schools open, letting kids go back to school. I would say that we scientists are working as fast and hard as we can, unendingly since January, to try to figure out as much as we can about the virus to keep people safe. And it's just one question after the next. But now that one of the most important ones I think you just raised, which is, can kids go back to school? If we can't get kids back to school, it's hard for society to function. And we're working very hard to figure out how to do that safely. Testing might be part of it. Mask wearing will be part of it. And maybe there will be some sort of rotation where not every kid goes to school every day, and they do some at home and some at school. But these are the questions I think we absolutely have to answer as soon as possible, and we're working on that to start getting things at least back to some semblance of normal, without running the risk of continuing to grow cases in our population. But there's no silver bullet at the moment. There's certainly no solid answer that I can give, except that there's a lot of unknowns. And what we can do though is we can at the very least start to consider sort of everything that's happening and really try to be collecting data on it. Say, okay, this school system opened up in this way, and this school system opened up in that way, and look at 1,000 different school systems and how they opened up, and see if there were any pieces of information that we can glean that can help us better understand what are the best and safest ways to do this. Because it's just these are questions that are certainly not easy to answer.
That was Michael Minna, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the video of this discussion on our Facebook pages at Forum HSPH and at PRI The World, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.
From PRX.